Welcome, everybody, to Crystal Kyle and Friends. And today, we are talking about a little thing that's called the State of the Union.
Indeed. Yes, no friend today outside of, I guess, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr.
Yeah, so then that is not a friend. That is very, very far from a friend, indeed.
It's not even a friend of me, just a villain at this point.
Yeah, so I'll try my best to put my bias aside for this to grade him on the proper Biden curve.
Yeah.
You know, try to put my normie hat on a little bit here and, and see how I think he did. So what we're going to do is we'll do a general breakdown and then we'll dive into specific clips that were the big moments from the night, if you will.
Yeah.
And I actually have thoughts that are all over the map on this. You know, do you feel the same?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever found it so difficult to put my personal feelings about something aside than watching the speech, because to me, just like the horrors that we're perpetrating in Gaza just kind of loom large over everything. But that being said, I will also try to put those emotions aside, because I mean, the only answer there isn't a speech. It's to actually change your policy, stop the bombing, and stop the genocide.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue it's a proper bias to have. One should have an anti-genocide bias.
It's like the bare minimum thing. I do have a litmus test when it comes to perpetrating a genocide.
Of course.
Yes, I'm a purist like that.
So here's how the speech went. Here was the breakdown. And we could talk a little bit about beforehand, there were massive protests that were blocking what they thought were going to be his route to the speech.
Yeah.
There were, I don't know if it was hundreds or thousands, but looking at the videos, it seemed like there were a lot of people out there, pro-Palestine folks, who were like, screw you, we want to even block your route. And they went some back way or whatever and ended up getting there.
Yeah.
But right off the bat, the beginning of the night came in hot. It was spicy from the beginning.
And it was significant because, I mean, obviously, I don't think they had any expectation that they would be able to keep him from doing the State of the Union. But they forced the mainstream networks, while they're waiting for Biden to get there, they did make Biden late because he had to go some long way around to avoid these protests. And so the whole country is seeing those images first, and that's setting the context for this speech. And of course, you know, we've seen the reporting that basically he's afraid to campaign because he can't go anywhere without facing protests. We saw Adam Schiff get shouted down at his victory speech. We saw Kirsten Gillibrand and, you know, this conflict between the protesters and these old people are freaking out at the breach of decorum that you dare, you know, call for the end of a genocide. But I think every single Democratic politician, and Joe Biden in particular, is feeling that pressure because they know anywhere they go, people are going to show up to remind them of how outrageously immoral their policy is.
So he started the speech with Ukraine, which is kind of a wild thing to start with, in my opinion. He quoted like FDR and maybe mentioned Lincoln or something.
Yeah.
And then you tried to link that to, we got to send Ukraine more money because Russia is going to take them over if we don't do that. Then from there, he transitioned to coming out against Trump for being a threat to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually very surprised at how kind of forceful and aggressive the call outs were against Trump, usually in these State of the Union speeches. You know, as I always say about Biden, he's perpetually stuck in 1993, and it's all this, you know, both sides type stuff and flowery language, and we believe in freedom and liberty and justice, and Americans can do anything. It's stuff like that. It's not like, my opponent's an asshole. He's way too extreme. That you shouldn't even consider this dude because that makes no damn sense. Basically, that's what he was doing. He brought up January 6th, and it was a very partisan part of the speech. But when I say that, I mean that actually in a positive sense.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I mean, the Republicans were melting down over it and acting like this was a campaign speech and all that stuff.
I mean, it was a campaign.
It was a campaign speech, but like, he needed a campaign speech, right? It was better than just some vague, flowery nonsense. That's like, you know, the classic, like an Obama type speech. Right? Let's come together. You know, it's not time for that right now.
Yeah. You saw those Biden instincts later in the speech when there was a line in there calling out Wall Street. And he was like, ad-libbed.
We actually have that.
We'll play that later. Yeah. It's like, oh, my God. But, you know, on the choice to start with Ukraine, not the choice I would have made, but it did have a logic to it. Because if you look at where his approval rating is highest issue by issue, Ukraine is actually number one. And so he feels like he's got kind of a strong hand to play there. And then he transitions into January 6th, which obviously, you know, is one of the things that I think people find most horrible about Trump, that he subjected the country to that and sat back while this was all happening, incited, et cetera, et cetera. And then he transitions into Roe versus Wade and IVF.
Yep. And that was, he was hitting them hard.
So he definitely front loaded with the areas that he felt were his strength. Now, again, with regard to Ukraine, I can't listen to his words about like democracy and human rights with, and, you know, his upset over Trump saying to Putin, do whatever the hell you want, when Biden is out there telling Netanyahu in Gaza, basically, do whatever the hell you want. So again, I can't hear those words anymore about Ukraine and the international rules-based order and all of this without seeing how just completely morally bankrupt and full of shit they are. But, you know, I think for your average voter, the main thing they wanted from this speech wasn't a specific policy or to hit this area or to go after Trump. It was just, is this man literally capable of performing the duties of the job? Is he so mentally gone that he's unable to even pull it together for 1 hour to deliver a decent teleprompter speech? And I think the choice of coming out very aggressive was an attempt to show, hey, I still got it in me. I still got fight in me. I still got more to give. And I think just, you know, his energy level, it's graded on like the biggest curve ever. The bar was literally on the floor. We're talking about he was able to get through a teleprompter speech and not have like a visible health event. But he pulled that off. He did pull that off.
Well, I saw that at least on my Twitter trending thing, Adderall was trending.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he was aggressive in the speech and he kept it together for the most part.
Yeah.
There were some moments, and again, we'll get to them. We actually have them in video. Mm-hmm. There's some parts where it was like, oh, the wheels are coming off,
the
bro.
Further you got into the speech, the more you were like, oh.
But he was able to pull it back together in those instances.
Yeah.
And then he gave the media all that the media needed to
go out there
and be like, the greatest speech of all time.
That's right.
It's a historic speech. That's what, you know, the Morning Joes of the world are going to say.
Yeah.
And so he went through all the things that we discussed. Then he does a decent part on economics and raising taxes on the rich.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes to, you know, restoring the child tax credit. Then he hits the Republicans on the whole border bill thing.
Moment was awkward. You have that to play, right? The immigration piece?
Yes, we do. We do have that to play. And guys, by the way, sign up on Substack if you want to see the full thing. You're only going to get a part of it if you're listening to the teaser clip on YouTube. The worst part, in my opinion, the Israel and Gaza portion. It absolutely sucked. We have that as well. I'll explain in detail why it sucked. But overall, what I would say in the speech is I think the general aggression was good. I like the fact that he like really did kind of go for Trump's jugular, as they said, the campaign said, this is what we're going to try to do. And that and the economics portions, I think were just flat out good.
Yeah.
He doesn't sound like Bill Clinton. He doesn't sound like Barack Obama when talking about economic stuff. He sounds more like Bernie on those issues. He's talking about raising taxes on the billionaires and making the corporations pay their fair share. And he has those moments, like you already pointed out, where he brings up Wall Street. He's like, they're not bad guys. They're not bad guys, but they didn't build the middle class. He does his classic Biden thing.
Yeah.
And he brags about, I'm from Delaware, where there's more corporations than anywhere else in the world.
Something to really be proud of.
Yeah, he does that. But he does that to sort of soften the blow of basically being like, the middle class are the people who really do the shit. You know, so he did on the economic stuff. I think he actually did a good job. I think it was smart for him to do the thing where he specifically called out shrinkflation.
Yeah,
because I feel like that's been an issue under his administration, not just inflation, but also shrinkflation. And he brings up Snickers bars to do it. He's like, we've all seen the thing where you get the package and it's 10% less. That's not okay. He does it. And people, you could see like some normie watching that like, yeah, that is sort of fucked up, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, we were talking before the speech about how in a different timeline when he's not aiding and abetting and facilitating genocide, you know, we would be out there after a speech like this and really defending him, because the economic pieces, you know, things that he actually has done in his administration, especially on antitrust, especially on labor. Sean Fain was there. He talked about the PRO Act, talked about the historic union drives. He's putting out there some, you know, specific things about what they're doing with regard to junk fees and shrinkflation, and talked a good bit also about, you know, lowering prescription drug prices and about housing. I thought the housing piece was really solid and really good. Like, there's a different timeline where we're actually, you know, very much encouraging people that this is not just a lesser of two evils, that there's a very notable difference in domestic policy between Trump and between Biden. But, you know, obviously he kind of killed that vibe with the rest with his foreign policy.
Yeah. So overall, I give it a C+. Maybe a B-, okay, if I'm being kind.
Mm-hmm.
But let's actually...
Let me ask you. Is that the absolute grade or is that the special Joe Biden grade? Like if Barack Obama gave the same performance, is it still a C+, B-?
Well, I mean, I find that's a good question. I find it almost impossible to not grade on a curve.
I know.
I'm grading Biden against Biden standards.
Yes.
Right? If I were to compare him, there's a million ways you can grade it. Like I can grade it against the platonic ideal of a president, in which case he gets a F-. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I can compare it in terms of rhetoric to somebody like Barack Obama, in which case it's going to be a worse grade. Because
yeah.
Barack Obama just, he had a way of speaking where everybody just sort of cummed their pants when he talked. Right? So like, if I'm grading it, I feel like the most normie way to look at it, if I'm trying to be fair, is grading Biden in relation to Biden and what he can be at his best.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be fair, I didn't think it would be even possible for him to get a C+ or a B-. Because I'm just like most people out there, I'm with the 86 or 90% of Americans who are like, this motherfucker, he ain't gonna make it 4 more years.
Yeah.
Right? So relative to that, yeah, it's like a C+ or a B-.
Relative to Joe Biden of this moment, I actually give it even a little higher than that. For him right now, I actually give it a B+ because he did the thing he needed to do. You know, he needed to convince people that he had just like basic capability to hold it together. He needed to give them his media allies the ability to spin this as some wonderful oratory in Joe Biden's back and see he was underestimated all the time, blah, blah, blah. And to shut up the increasingly loud chatter and direct arguments from people like Ezra Klein and Nate Silver and others that he really needed to step aside. And he did that. So he accomplished what he needed to accomplish. Again, the broader problems that he has with the base of the party, in particular on Gaza, there's no speech that can fix that without a dramatic change in policy. So that was not really on the table to accomplish last night. But, you know, the piece that he could do, he did do. Now, if this was Barack Obama and the performance was as it was last night, we'd be like, I think Barack Obama needs to see a doctor. I think there's something wrong with Barack Obama. You know, for him, it'd be like an F, right? So it is the biggest curve of all time. Or Bill Clinton, same thing, you know. But for Biden, at this moment in his life, at this moment in his presidency, I think this was the absolute best you could have possibly expected.
Okay, so now I'm going to jump around a little bit here on the clips in terms of like the chronological order of when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So before anything... We'll get to the Biden clips, but I want to first show a piece of the Republican response.
Okay.
Because this, holy shit.
Well, I want to say too, when I got back from the live stream last night, you know, we were busy doing the live stream reacting to just the Biden State of the Union. And the first thing you said to me when I came in was like, you got to see this Katie Brer response. It was bad. And I have never seen anything like it. I know people had all kinds of ways of describing this. I can't describe it. It is like nothing I've ever seen before.
Okay. Total dead-eyed psychopath. This woman, cops need to go check this woman's basement because holy cow. You want to talk about one tweet I saw that I liked was holy first year of drama class, Batman, or something like that. Because it looks like she's like in seventh grade and she's told, now you need to show emotion when you're acting and really get into it.
Speak slowly and enunciate and show a lot of emotion. Yeah. All right,
so let's show everybody, then we'll react.
Meanwhile, the Chinese Communist Party is undercutting America's workers. China is buying up our farmland, spying on our military installations, and spreading propaganda through the likes of TikTok. You see, the CCP knows that if it conquers the minds of our next generation, it conquers America. And what does President Biden do? Well, he bans TikTok for government employees, but creates an account for his own campaign. Y'all, you can't make this stuff up. Look, We all recall when presidents faced national security threats with strength and resolve. That seems like ancient history. Right now, our commander-in-chief is not in command. The free world deserves better than a dithering and diminished leader.
Mr. President, you must stop it. I demand you do the right thing. It's like, and she tries to like go back and forth. She tries to switch emotions, like a light switch.
Right.
You know what I mean? And she'll like calm down and start talking in a different way. It's like, what is it? There's something written in the laws of nature where the people who do the Republican response are absolute weirdo freaks.
Totally.
Bobby Jindal. Classic Bobby Jindal.
Oh, that was, I think this is up there with Bobby Jindal. I think it was that bad.
Then
Jindal is historically bad.
Then we went back and saw the Marco Rubio, where he's in the middle of talking. And
that was hilarious.
Guys, yeah, I'm sure a lot of you in our audience remember it, but you got, go watch that Marco Rubio response. I don't remember what year it was.
The funniest thing, how he's taking these little furtive glances to the camera.
He goes to sip the water, but he, in his mind, he acts like, all right, let me shut off the fact that people are watching me. And I'm going to go take this real quick because if people can't see me, like he could have just been like, excuse me one second, and then take a sip of water, acting on some normal shit. And people be like, yeah, he was thirsty. But instead, he. And he had the mean cotton mouth leading up to it. And you could hear, you can literally hear the cotton mouth.
He's like, bad. I mean, when it's like that, you just have to acknowledge, like, I think the best thing to do in that situation is just acknowledge the fact that, like, this is a big moment. I'm a little nervous. Let me just grab some water. You know what
of
I mean?
Of course.
Like, everyone would be like, oh, of course. It's a big moment. He's nervous. That's normal. You know? But instead, you have to do like the least normal thing possible.
You can turn it into an endearing thing.
Bobby Jindal. I wish we actually had a clip of it because that man was, he was being billed as the next big Republican thing, presidential candidate. Like, this is the guy.
There are all these
glowing pro. Oh, he's so smart. And he really understands healthcare down to the nuts and bolts. And after he gave that response, that was it. That was it. It was over. And it is a little similar with Katie Britt. The only thing is she's new in the Senate. She just got elected, I don't know, like 2 years ago or whatever. Anyway, people don't really know who she is. But in advance of this response, people were billing her like, oh, it's this, you know, this young woman. She's really up and coming. Like, you might be hearing a lot more from her. Don't think so.
No.
I do not think so. You were saying the Senate Republican Twitter account, rather than posting clips, they're just posting quotes from it. I mean, that tells you how bad
now,
it is.
To be fair,
universally panned.
The general GOP account was putting videos. She was putting videos on her own Twitter, right? But by the way, I read the replies. Woo! Even the Republicans are like,
yeah,
I don't know about this fella.
Well,
I don't know. I don't know about this.
Last night when we were doing the live stream, Emily Jashinsky, who's on the right, kept looking at the tweets about Katie Britt. And she's like, it looks like she's really bombing. It looks like this did not go well.
Bomb so, city, bro.
But even on the content there, she's acting like it is, he's about to spark World War III because he has a campaign TikTok account. Like, that was the substance of
but
what she was arguing
there. This is what Republicans do, right? This is what Republicans do. They take the dumbest possible criticisms of Biden and they make it seem like this is the biggest. It's like with the border thing, right? He gives them everything they want. And then they're like, why are you doing an open borders bill? And it's like, you're just a fucking idiot at that point if this is the kind of stuff that you're saying.
Yeah,
and then, by the way, afterwards, she took a picture with her family, which, by the way, I feel terrible for those kids that this absolute psychopath freak dragged them into a public life and a public profile because took a picture with some teenage kids, right? Or whatever, however old they are. And they took a picture in their kitchen. And as people pointed out, if you look around the kitchen, not a single thing is out. It's just like a totally blank kitchen. And people were like, where's the shit in your kitchen? You're trying to make it seem like I'm an everyman. I'm the standard American just like you. And then you're in some Stepford wife-ass house that looks like it's some AI-generated picture.
Right.
It's a swing and a miss on every conceivable level. And by the way, as I pointed out, I don't understand why Trump is not the only one giving the response. He's the guy. We know he's the guy in the Republican Party. Why are we pretending like this rando has any shot whatsoever? Forget 2028 now. dunsies for her.
Oh, forget about
like,
it.
But like, why are we pretending like anybody else can be the person right now? Yeah. Trump was live tweeting his reaction to Joe Biden and shitposting and putting like face app filters on videos of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Like, I don't understand why he wasn't the one that they went to.
I don't even know why they do these responses anymore.
I know.
Because they just don't go well.
They're cursed.
Even the ones that aren't like so surreal you can't even wrap your head around, as this one was, they're it's not like they do anything.
Yeah.
It's just forgettable. People don't really watch. They don't really care. They're like mildly awkward at best and politically catastrophic at worst. There was a moment there for a while where it'd be like four different responses. Oh, there's the
Democratic Party. The Freedom Caucus response.
There's the Freedom Caucus. And there was like a whole, you know, whole buffet of responses pick from. But I think the era of the, you know, excitement over the response is kind of over. And so now it's more of a curse than a blessing to get. It used to be big honor to get picked to be the response. Now it's like signing your political death certificate. But I'm also just looking at this party. I'm like, do you not have one normal person? If you just picked one random person off the street to read the speech, it would have been way better than this weirdo.
Even this woman's video pitching that she was going to do the response was 10 times more normal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a video of her like, tune in when I give my response or
and
whatever.
It was fine.
I wouldn't say fine.
Okay.
But I would say it's
way
better.
We're grading on the Katie Britt curve now.
Yes. Way better than what she ended up delivering.
That's who coached her and was like, this is great, you're nailing it, you know, and wasn't like, maybe reel it in like 100%.
You know the answer to this. They're surrounded by yes men and yes women. That's what it is. It's like it's the same with Biden, with everything that's going on with him destroying Gaza. Like, he's surrounded by people who are like, Mr. President, you really showed them.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's what it is. It's sycophants who are just trying to get a paycheck.
Yeah.
And so nobody tells her, like, just so you know, you look like a freak.
Right.
Like, you look like nobody should listen to a word you say and they'd run away from you.
Yeah. She makes Biden look fantastic in comparison.
Oh, no doubt about that. All right. So now, let's talk about one of the more controversial moments of the night.
Okay.
So this, of course, referring to on the way in, Marjorie Taylor Greene was trying to get Joe Biden to take a pin for Lake and Riley. And this is somebody who was killed by an undocumented immigrant. And she was on that House floor with the MAGA hat on, which people were like, that's a violation of the rules.
That was Sagar.
Yeah,
Sagar was saying that.
I guess he took it. Because when he was on the podium, she started screaming out, like, say her name or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then this moment happens. Take a look.
I'd be a winner. Not really. Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals? To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. But look, if we change the dynamic at the border, people pay these smugglers $8,000 to get across the border because they know if they get by and let into the country.
All right. So a number of things to point out there. The very beginning, I'd be a winner. Not really.
What was he talking about?
Okay, so here's my guess as to what happened.
Yeah.
The I'd be a winner thing was on the teleprompter in the context of something.
Okay.
But he hears Marjorie Taylor Greene screaming.
Oh, that and then throws he's reacting him off, to that.
And then he's kind of reacting to that, but it's very bad optics. And by the way, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you absolute fucking moron. If you just step aside right there and let him go, that's going to be the moment where he trips over his dick.
Right.
I warned you about this before. I was like, somebody's going to make some noise.
Yeah.
It's going to throw him off. He's going to lose his place in the teleprompter. And then, boom, you get your Biden moment that all of them want. And she couldn't help but stay involved in the interaction and then giving him a chance to kind of get out of it.
Right.
But now let's talk about the heart of it. So,
well, 1 second. So I found the place in the because they released the remarks as prepared for delivery. So what he was supposed to say about the border bill was it's not about him or me. it would be a winner for America. My Republican friends, you owe it to the American people to get this bill done. And so, yeah, he misread it. He said, I'd be a winner. And then he realizes, like, that doesn't make any sense.
But she kind of got him off.
Yeah.
Yeah. She, by her interrupting, it made it.
It threw him off.
Right.
Yes.
So, so the part that a lot of Democrats are pissed at is that he said, you know, he mispronounced her name, by the way. He said Lincoln Riley.
Yeah.
Lincoln Riley.
Right.
But they're mad that he said, called the person that killed Lincoln Riley an illegal. She was killed by an illegal. To me, this was the least surprising thing Biden has ever said.
Yeah.
Because as I always tell everybody, he's perpetually stuck in 1993. And in his vernacular, illegal immigrant is, they honestly were lucky he didn't say illegal alien.
Yeah.
Because that was the vernacular until like, what, 2000?
Yeah.
2006? Something like that. And so that part to me was not surprising.
It's not surprising. It's actually, it's just a little bit of a mask slip. I saw somebody commenting on Twitter. If you went back and listened to the way Joe Biden and every other Democrat was talking about immigration.
Obama did too.
In the, no. I'm talking about in 2019.
Oh, okay.
When they were, you know, really, remember when they were all like speaking their high school Spanish on the stage and they were talking in only terms of compassion. And then you showed this where he's just blurting out, like, killed by an illegal. It's jarring, the difference between how he postured during the campaign versus how he's governing now. So, I mean, it's perfect. It's perfectly emblematic of the Democratic Party that of everything in that speech, and especially when you consider, you know, the Gaza piece, that what they're upset about is just like this word that he used. To describe an illegal immigrant or an undocumented immigrant, like that they would parse over the language more than the substance is a perfect example of, you know, how weirdly obsessive the Democratic Party has gotten over language specifically. But the policy also really sucks. And it's both immoral and it's also politically nonsensical. Because on the one hand, they want to argue like, oh, Donald Trump is going to do fascism at the border. You can't elect him. And on the other hand, he wants to go out and be like, hey, Donald Trump, work with me on the border.
This. Yeah, no, I've pointed that out, too. It's a massive contradiction. It makes absolutely no sense.
And you've just completely caved to the Republican narrative about immigrants, about immigration, and about the border. You just accepted their framing.
But this is what he's always believed.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
This is the
real thing. The 2020 version was the departure.
So honestly, I don't understand. Everybody's being very Pollyanna-ish about this. And it's like, you guys don't know this is Joe Biden's opinion. There's videos of Joe Biden in the 1990s talking about how we need to build a giant barrier at the southern border. He was for Trump's wall before Trump was for his own wall. Okay, this is who he is. What was Obama's nickname when he was president?
Deporter-in-chief.
The Deporter-in-Chief. Well, who was his vice president?
Mm-hmm.
You think Biden has clean hands? You think he didn't have any idea what was going on?
Mm-hmm.
This is who he's been.
Agreed.
So, I'm not surprised by it at all, but it's amazing to me that the language where when he says illegal, that's a bigger scandal to a lot of these Democrats than the portion on Gaza, which is him running cover for a fucking genocide.
Right.
And that, to that, I would say, your priorities are wrong. You're just wrong if that's your reaction to it. Especially because the rest of the sentence, this part is annoying me. Because people are not actually taking his full sentence in its full context. Because he goes on to say, how many thousands of people are killed by legals?
Right.
In other words, yes, he used an illegal, but it was in the context of actually defending undocumented immigrants, right?
Right.
And everybody's acting like that's not what he was doing. That is what he was doing. He was saying effectively that there's a higher crime rate among naturalized citizens and natural born citizens, you know, compared to undocumented immigrants and documented immigrants, by the way.
Yeah.
So that's a fact. And he's pointing that out. But people are so caught up on the language that they're refusing to even acknowledge that the point he was making was actually a correct point.
It was a correct point. But it was very awkwardly made.
It was very awkwardly made.
Because, like, you and I know what he meant because we know the statistics. We know that the native-born population commits more crimes than the undocumented population. We know how grotesque it is that these, you know, these instances of violence from the undocumented immigrants, that those are used to smear every immigrant as some sort of violent, immoral criminal. We know all of those pieces. So when we hear him say that, we're like, oh, this is what he means. But it was when he's delivering it, it was definitely one of those moments where I was like, oh, this is going off the rails.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that even if he had said she was killed by an illegal immigrant.
Yeah.
There would still be the backlash. Right? Don't you agree?
I think it is particularly jarring to just call them an illegal. It feels like more of a slur. I understand that. Than, you know, if you say illegal immigrant, I don't know that there would have been as much of a backlash. But your core point of the fixation on the word versus, you know, even if you just keep it on immigration, the policy itself, you know, a bunch of Democrats were running around like they really pulled one over on the Republicans because they put forward
we gave them everything they wanted.
Yeah, draconian immigration bill and completely accepted their framing and are like, we too can be fascists at the border and we're just as cruel and assholes as they are. And they thought this was some great victory. Like, focus on that, even if you're just focused on immigration. And then, you know, you put next to it the fact that he's still running cover for a genocide and announcing the most insulting PR bullshit with this whole port situation, which I know we're going to get to. And that's not your focus right now. Your big criticism of the Biden administration is a word that he used. It is bizarre and pathetic.
Well, and also a lot of the same people who are attacking him for saying an illegal. Later on in the speech, when Biden did the hypocrisy burn of the right on, I'm actually the one for tough border control and you guys are not for the bill.
Yeah.
Those same people were cheering it.
Right.
So that's the part that's frustrating me. Like, you're going to get mad over the language, but then you're also like, yeah, you should have done Biden's border fascism bill.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense, especially in the context of, like, you pointed out and I pointed out that, like, yeah, the real thing to be pissed about is the Gaza portion.
Right.
Let's go to the Gaza portion. And then after that, we'll cut it off. We still have a bunch more clips. You guys are going to want to sign up on Substack to see the rest of this, but this will be the last portion that you see for free in the teaser clip.
One more thing on the Republicans on immigration that I just feel needs pointing out too is that they like to pretend like Biden is some like open borders, you know, socialist
which
on
is,
this.
Which is just a lie. It's complete, just a lie.
Like, they, if you just look
they
at
can't
record,
even believe that.
I know. I agree. I think some parts of the Republican base perhaps have been made to believe it. But just a cursory glance at his record, you know, shows you that it's very far, very far from the truth. So on that level, it's, you know, the whole situation is preposterous, too.
Right. All right. So now let's look at the Gaza portion.
I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. They're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time. And I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel. My entire career, no one has a stronger record with Israel than I do. I challenge any of you here. I'm the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. But there is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees Palestinians can live in peace with peace and dignity. And there's no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its neighbors.
Now, before that portion that you just saw, there was a very long, like, prelude to it.
Yep.
All about October 7th and Hamas, the terrorist group, and Israel defending itself. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was watching that portion, my blood was boiling. Then he hits you with what you just heard.
Yeah.
And it's such fucking chicken shit because it's just PR ass covering. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to build a port, which is probably going to take at least 2 months longer, even if everything goes perfectly. There are people, hundreds of thousands or millions, starving right now. Yeah. 2 million Gazans are homeless. We are giving the money and the weapons to Netanyahu as he's doing an ethnic cleansing and a genocide. There was an article that came out the other day. We've sent weapons to Israel over 100 times.
That's right.
Throughout this process. Okay. If you wanted to stop that, you would cut off the money, cut off the weapons, condemn them at the UN, sanction them, and there's all the international pressure you need. Everybody knows the story about Ronald Reagan calling up the Israeli prime minister when they're carpet bombing Lebanon and saying, you're doing a Holocaust, stop it. And then 20 minutes later, they fucking stopped it. Yeah. Everybody knows the story about George H.W. Bush conditioning $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel on the condition that they freeze settlement building. You know what they did? They froze settlement building.
Yep.
We wear the pants. We're the boss here. We're the superpower. But he ain't fucking acting like it. He's acting like he's cucking himself to Netanyahu while trying to do PR ass covering, because that's exactly what he is doing.
Well, he's not acting like it because he actually supports what Netanyahu is doing.
Correct.
I mean, if he wanted to stop it, he would stop it. So he's under enough pressure domestically. They've sort of woken up to the fact that this whole situation is a disaster for him politically. And so rather than actually changing the policy and ending the genocide, which could be done, and anyone gaslighting you into thinking like, oh, he's doing all he can, complete and utter bullshit. Rather than doing that, they're going to try to change the messaging. And so they sent in these little piddly, pathetic airdrops of aid. And now this ridiculous expensive, risky boondoggle of this port that's going to take months to construct. And by the way, has all the same issues that, you know, that you have right now with getting trucks in. It's still going to be Israel who is responsible for checking this aid. And we have no idea how it's going to be distributed. So it's just, it's so insane and insulting on so many levels. I don't think that anyone who cares about this issue is fooled by it whatsoever. But they've realized that, all right, we got to change. They think they can get away with just changing the language and pretending like saying the word ceasefire, like appropriating that language
for 6 weeks,
even as what they mean is not a ceasefire. It's he says we need an immediate ceasefire for at least 6 weeks,
which means what happens after those 6 weeks, Joe?
The genocide starts.
What happens
again
after those 6 weeks?
That's
Joe?
Right. That's right. That's right.
What are we talking about here? And I love, notice the specific language, too, when he says we need a 2-state solution over time.
Mm hmm.
Oh, over time.
Right.
Has it not been enough time already?
Yes.
Have Palestinians not been suffering for long enough already? Over time? You know what they mean. What they mean is we want to come up with some and this is liberal Democrats who have a slightly different view than the right in Israel. But what they want is effectively like a Bantustan version of a Palestine where they don't have any sovereignty, any independence, any right to self-defense.
That's right.
People are talking about, oh, Israel's right to self-defense. Do Palestinians have a right to self-defense? So that's what they want to do. So it's this sort of bullshit, less than a state thing. And he wants that over time.
Yeah.
Spare me.
The framing from the jump, too, you talked about the long like buildup about October 7th and Hamas terrorism, mm-hmm. et cetera. The framing is, I have the remarks in front of me. This crisis began on October 7th.
Insane.
With a massacre by the terrorist
insane
group Hamas.
Insane.
Like, that's
insane
the first thing that
insane
ever happened. Yeah. And so that, I mean, even just starting there, it tells you everything about the framing. I saw some reporting last night that allegedly Netanyahu and the Israelis were pissed that he used the Hamas casualty numbers of 30,000 dead, which is probably, I mean, I think that's probably a wild understatement, too, at this point. We know from
Euromed Monitor,
that, you know, they count also those estimated to be buried under the rubble. But even that, I think at this point, is probably an undercount because it's just chaos there. How can you know the toll?
Did you see what Ralph Nader said? He released a long thing where he said, I think the actual number dead is about 200,000, which is there's a big gap between Euromed Monitor says 39,000. He says 200,000, even if the truth is somewhere in the middle. Right.
It's
let's say 60,000.
An unbelievable.
It's literally a genocide. We are witnessing a genocide. He's arming it. He's funding it. He's responsible for it. And at this point, if you can't shove your head in the sand about it anymore. You just can't do it.
Babies are dying from starvation every single day.
Every day.
Every single day. Like, that's where we're at. And it's because of our policy. I mean, we're, you know, nearly as culpable as Israel because we're the ones that give them the green light. We're the ones that give them the weapons. We're the ones that give them the diplomatic cover. We are as complicit in this as we could possibly be. And for him to, instead of saying, let's end the bombing to stop the suffering, it's let's over months risk our own soldiers and spend our own money to build some bullshit port. It's just, it's disgusting. It's idiotic. It's absurd. It's preposterous. It's morally bankrupt. It's insane. It's an insane response.
And I want to give a shout out to Summer Lee,
yep.
Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib,
yep.
who all wore kefias.
Yeah.
And they were holding up signs that said, stop sending bombs and like lasting ceasefire
lasting
now.
Lasting ceasefire.
I want to give them a tremendous amount of credit because that's brave in the belly of the beast, knowing that you're going to be the target of like $15 million in AIPAC money trying to take your ass down. That's brave. It's also brave. Shout out to every single one of those protesters who tried to block his route. Shout out to all the protesters who went to Adam Schiff's event and shouted his punk ass down.
Yep.
Shout out to all the protesters who went to the Kirsten Gillibrand event and shouted her ass down. These people, it's just like with George W. Bush and with Dick Cheney, where we all agreed they shouldn't get a moment of peace the rest of their lives.
Nope.
At the very least, they should be absolute national pariahs, where they feel like I can't go to the store and buy milk and bread without people coming up and yelling at me and calling me a war criminal.
Yep.
The exact same thing applies in this scenario. If they're not going to be locked up in prison for the rest of their lives, as they deserve to be for what's going on here, then God bless all the people who are trying to make their lives a living hell. At the very least, I want it so that when these people put their head down on their pillows at night, they feel like, Jesus fucking Christ, what have I done? What have I done to garner this reaction?
I don't know if they have that much of a soul left.
Well,
but
I like that people are trying to force them to have a realization of what the fuck they are.
Feel some discomfort. Also, shout out to all the people who have been voting uncommitted. We had the Hawaii caucus results.
That
30% for uncommitted.
That was
I was
big.
Trying to just look up. I think there's 20 plus uncommitted delegates now to the DNC. And obviously, there's still a lot more states to vote. So, you know, it's encouraging that. It is inspiring to see the number of people who still have a soul and can look at these images and say, this is absolutely unacceptable.
Like, yeah.
We have to do whatever we can to stop this. And, you know, I never could, I guess this is was a failure of imagination, but I just never could have imagined that we could watch this genocide unfold on social media and for this many months, just not just allow it to happen, but to actively facilitate it, run cover for it. It's unreal.
It's an eye-opening moment
so
for a lot of people.
So yeah. Radicalizing.
Oh, absolutely.
So radicalizing.
Absolutely.
And that's the piece that, like, you know, it really is difficult for me to evaluate the rest of the speech talking about, like, junk fees and...
Yeah, for good reason. I mean, for good reason.
And I'm not saying those things aren't important. I'm not saying that, you know, the economic suffering of people here isn't important. Obviously, that's incredibly important. Like, that suffering is very real as well. But when you're watching these babies being starved, when you're watching their entire, you know, the entire Gaza Strip destroyed, no civilian infrastructure left, people have no homes, they're completely displaced, they're clustered in Rafah, and now there's threatened, you know, and they're already bombing Rafah, but threatened invasion there too. The number of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people whose lives are literally at risk right now, it's just hard to get those things out of your head.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like saying Himmler was for paid family leave.
Right.
Like that's what it feels like at this point. You know what I mean? So it's understandable that our reaction is what it is.
Yeah.
All right. But we're going to switch gears here now, guys. Guys, we still have a bunch of clips to get to. Do us a favor. If you want to see the rest of this, sign up on Substack. You got the link below. If you sign up and pay $5 a month, you get the video of every show and you'll get the video for this. You'll get it the same day, usually a day early. You can also sign up for free if you want to hear the audio version. And that usually comes out a day later. It's sent right to your email inbox. Just the audio podcast if you want to do it that way. So there's a free option. There's a $5 a month option. Thank you to everybody who does support this show because we've never had a conversation with any advertiser. We take no ad money for this at all. This show is all funded through small dollar donations. So everybody who's paying that $5 a month, you guys are funding this show. Thank you very much. We love you guys. Everybody, hang around, check it out, because we're about to go into a whole bunch more clips, and I saved some good ones. So, all right. Having said that.
Yes.
So now we're going to switch gears, and I got a few moments that were big moments and interesting moments that are kind of the opposite, where Biden was kind of freaking it.
Pretty good.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's go to the portion on billionaires and tax cuts. Take a look at this.
Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. I will. That's the proposal. Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealth. That's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share. Look.
So we also had moments where he talked about billionaires, and he wants to propose a minimum tax on them of 25%, where they can't deduct anything under 25%. I thought that was good. He talked about raising the corporate tax rate. He also made very clear people who make $400,000 a year or less, I don't want to raise their taxes, not a single penny. And usually, as a general rule, when I saw him like conversing with the audience, my initial reaction was like, oh no.
Like, oh
no.
How's this going to go?
You're going to lose your space in the teleprompter.
Yeah.
You're going to, you know, stutter, mess up, whatever it is. But there were a couple instances where he did the interaction and it worked, right? It was like, there was one previous time where he did this too, where he, was it over Social Security and Medicare?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
he was like, oh, you guys don't want to cut it.
And
okay.
that actually boxed them in.
It did
box
them in.
They had to
in.
Give
That's
up
right.
there because mm-hmm. they were kind of inching towards, and a bunch of them had floated various cuts. And after that, that was done. And he did the same thing. I actually think this was his best moment of the whole speech, because not only was it lucid and the content was good and he was, you know, in the right place politically, he had the, you know, the exchange there that worked well for him. And it has a real outcome of, once again, sort of boxing them in of like, oh, so you don't want to do these giant tax cuts for corporations, very similar to the way he boxed them in last time around.
And just so everybody's clear, this is literally one of the most solid proposals that yeah, Trump
course.
Has made.
Of course.
Running for re-election. He
yeah.
was giving a speech in Mar-a-Lago and he told a room full of rich pricks. He was like, I'm going to cut your taxes. I'm going to cut your taxes again. And it's like, okay, if you guys want to play this game and box yourself in a corner on it, I'm your Huckleberry. This is exactly what I want.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because they realize how unpopular their own proposals are, so that when they're confronted with their own proposals, they're like, oh no,
I'm not for that, bro. What are you talking about?
Yeah, no way. That's not us. And then they're like, oh shit, I guess we can't do that anymore. So yeah, I did think that that was probably his best moment in the whole speech.
And then, I mean, you know, the Sean Fain thing.
Yeah.
The idea that a U.S. president is now shouting out the head of the UAW in his speech. That is a big deal.
Yeah.
That is sort of a throwback to the pre-neoliberal era.
Absolutely.
You would never see Bill Clinton do that. You would never see Barack Obama do that.
That's right.
That's just not, they're the third way types. They're the, you know, we're not left, we're not right, we're above the fray and reasonable, and we work with management and we work with the unions and we find a path forward for everybody. And
yeah.
This was just, no, I'm going to side with labor.
Yeah. And actually, during the Clinton-Obama era, plenty of Democrats who were like, I'm going to join up with Republicans and do the union busting as well.
That's right.
Which is, I mean, both outrageously immoral and also incredibly stupid politically, because that's where so much of your organizing and power in the party came from. But no, it was a genuinely historic moment when Joe Biden joined the picket line, when UAW workers were striking and trying to secure a better contract, which they very successfully did. And it didn't stop there, because now UAW is undertaking this nationwide drive to organize auto workers, you know, places like Tesla and foreign automakers that in the South that have never really never been unionized, certainly successfully, and have faced very few even attempts. But the fact that they've got this head of steam and they've got some confidence, that's a big deal. I mean, again, in a different timeline, I would be talking nonstop about Sean Fain and Biden's NLRB and what that means for workers now, what it's going to mean for workers in the future. It's one of those things, though, too, where because he abandoned the tangible short-term benefits of Build Back Better, a lot of the best parts of his agenda are more medium or long-term, or people don't really connect them to Joe Biden. Like those workers who are organizing and like sticking their necks out to try to unionize, they're probably not necessarily connecting that to like, oh, and I have a better shot because the Biden NLRB and they, you know, Jennifer Abruzzo took this decision or whatever. And that's part of what paved the way. So I also think that's part of why his economic approval numbers are so dismal, in spite of the fact that there are some good numbers to point to, is because people, whatever's going well for people in their lives, they don't really give him credit for. And the things that are going badly, you know, prices still being high and them still feeling squeezed on housing and all sorts of other issues, those they do put the blame on him for. And they don't have any confidence because of his age and his like sort of enfeebled state that he's really going to be able to deliver that for them in a meaningful way.
So I think the fact that Sean Fain, for a while, he withheld his endorsement, then he eventually endorsed Biden. I actually think that because of that, it makes it more likely Biden will do even better things for unions. Do you agree with that? I think he's so old school politician, man-to-man, personality-based type guy where it's like, okay, you did a solid for me, now I got to do a solid for you type thing. I think that makes it so the voice of the UAW is now louder in the room.
I think that's probably true. But I also think the reality is, so the thing he mentioned the PRO Act again last night, which, okay, good.
In what, like for 1 second, pass the PRO Act.
Yeah,
said.
I mean, I'm glad it gets mentioned and it's not completely forgotten, but obviously I haven't, it's not going to get passed because he's not willing to get rid of the filibuster.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it's not going to get through. So that's just like, you know, a sort of a shout out and a wish list thing that's aspirational, but not going to actually be achieved. So I think the best we can really hope for is that he keeps a similarly militant team in place at the National Labor Relations Board because continues to use like the bully pulpit to encourage these sort of militant worker actions. But I don't really know that he would go beyond that in a second term. But that is an area where it is night and day between Biden and Trump. Biden is the best Democratic president we've had in our lifetime in terms of labor rights. Not to say it's perfect. We can all remember what happened with the rail workers, but he's way better than Obama, way better than Clinton. And night and day between him and Trump. Trump stacks the National Labor Relations Board with a bunch of like union busters and aggressively attacks worker rights. So the contrast is massive with regard to that. And we saw it, I don't know if you guys remember, during that UAW drive, during their strike, you saw Biden actually going to the picket line and standing with workers. And you saw Trump do some fake worker rally at a non-union shop.
While pretending like he was talking to union workers.
Correct.
Very dishonest.
So, you know, it just in that one interaction, you can see their different approaches to these things. And as a businessman, he was always a union buster. So we know where he stands on this.
So we have another moment like this where there's a stark contrast where I'm curious what your thoughts are, because I know what mine are. I'm curious if you agree with it. So this is like the January 6th portion and the democracy portion. Take a look.
Just like History Watch 3 years ago on January 6th, when insurrectionists stormed this very Capitol and placed a dagger to the throat of American democracy. Many of you are here on that darkest of days. We all saw with our own eyes the insurrectionists were not patriots. They'd come to stop the peaceful transfer of power, to overturn the will of the people. January 6th lies about the 2020 election and the plots to steal the election posed a great, gravest threat to U.S. democracy since the Civil War. But they failed. America stood. America stood strong. And democracy prevailed. We must be honest. The threat to democracy must be defended. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. As I've done ever since being elected to office, I ask all of you without regard to party to join together and defend democracy. Remember your oath of office is defending against all threats, foreign and domestic. Respect
respect free and fair elections, restore trust in our institutions, and make clear political violence has absolutely no place, no place in America, zero place. Again, it's not hyperbole to suggest history is watching.
I thought that was really strong. And that was very early on in the speech.
Yeah.
I think he's just hitting the normie nerve there over and over and over, and makes it so that, you know, I think it's stuff like this, which is why you see like over half of Nikki Haley supporters are like, I'm going to vote for Biden.
I also think a lot of those Nikki Haley supporters are just basically Democrats already, or like independents who always vote Democrat or voted for Joe Biden last time around. But listen, his best bet for re-election is not that anyone has any, you know, confidence that he's going to really deliver for them and be some FDR style, like, you know, transformational president. His best re-election bet is that people are just disgusted with Trump. And
that's what this does.
That's what this
heightens
does.
That. It's, hey, they're so extreme. They're so beyond the pale. You can't even consider this. He says he wants to be a dictator, all that stuff.
And I think it's, you know, I think it's the strongest case Joe Biden can make. And I do think that this cuts to the core of people, why people are disgusted with Trump and would, you know, not want to go back to another Trump presidency. It's also very possible we have the January 6th criminal trial, the Jack Smith one in D.C., playing out right around election day. But so, you know, I do think that this is effective. It's more effective than I honestly would have anticipated. I think the midterms showed that.
Right.
And that's the thing is, you know, and going back to the Katie Britt response too, like the sense that, okay, I may not be happy with Joe Biden. I may think he's way too old to be doing this anymore. But these are a bunch of like weird freaks and fringe characters with crazy views on IVF, you know, trying to ban IVF and national abortion ban and stop the steal in January 6th. Like, these people are just lunatics. We can't possibly stomach voting for them again. So, yeah, I think for him, this is one of the stronger things he can lead into.
55% of the Republican candidates in the midterms believed and promoted the completely factually incorrect thing that Trump won the 2020 election. That, I think, was a big strike against them in the eyes of the American public. And that's why the red wave ultimately was a red trickle and it didn't really materialize.
Yeah,
I think it's that. And I think it's abortion. And I think those two themes, the more they get hammered away on by the Democrats, the more that helps the Democrats. Because like you say, it's not like, hey, you know, you like me or I'm doing a phenomenal job. It's like, you really want these psychos in control?
Yeah.
Because they're absolute psychos and you know they're psychos.
Yeah.
And people's reaction is kind of like, yeah, they are kind of psychos. Are. So that's why you have Trump's hardcore base, immovable, no denying that. But his base is only what his base is, right?
Yeah. And on abortion, you know, Biden said, oh, I'm going to codify Roe, make it the law of the land. Like, no, you're not. Because you're
He's not
going to get rid of the filibuster and you're not going to have a filibuster proof majority in the Senate. So you're not going to do that. But I don't think people expect him to do that. I think it's just a bulwark against whatever crazy insanity Republicans may have in store.
Like banning IVF.
And, you know, they immediately after that Alabama decision, they wanted to come out and be like, oh, no, not
Bro,
at all.
Bro, us,
no,
we
not
love
us
it.
At all.
What?
And so the Democrats did something actually intelligent for once. And we're like, oh, great. We have a bill here that would protect IVF nationwide. And they're like, yeah, we're not going to sign on to that.
Unbelievable.
So
this is what
too,
they do.
You know?
This is what they do.
But that was a rare, actual, intelligent political move by the Democrats to force their hand on that.
Well, and why were they able to do it? Because there was no big donor money that got involved that put the Democrats on the wrong side.
True.
So, and they do this, I mean, to be fair, they do this with guns too. They've done this a number of times with guns. Well, they'll bring up good legislation and then the Republicans will be against it. And since the Democrats aren't taking NRA money, they can posture and they can grandstand and they can do a messaging bill and it can work.
Yeah.
Right. And this is an area where people care a lot about it, man. Even in these red states, you see every time they vote directly on abortion rights, overwhelmingly, it passes, even in the reddest of red states.
Well, and the polling has shifted after Dobbs, too, where people are way more supportive of abortion rights than they were prior. I mean, it was a wake-up call for a lot of people of what it actually would look like. And, you know, it has opened Pandora's box. I think that's what is really evidenced by that Alabama decision, which would effectively kill and ban IVF completely, is like, oh, things that we didn't even think were in question anymore are suddenly in question. IVF, you know, we're going back to these freaking stem cell debates we had during the in the early 2000s. Mm. All that stuff is now back on the table. And I also want to say with regards to Trump, obviously he put the justices on the bench who overturned Roe versus Wade and who were chosen specifically because of their commitment to doing so. Even though no one thinks that Donald Trump's number one personal issue that he cares about is abortion, he doesn't care, right? But his first administration gave the anti-abortion movement basically everything they were asking for. And they are looking now that you do have this post-Roe environment. And they're looking at things like, oh, if we enforce the Comstock Act, we could effectively use the executive branch to ban abortion nationwide without even having to go through Congress.
Look how creative.
Those are the sort of things that are actually on the table. And again, it's not because I think Trump like really cares about the issue. Not at all. If anything, he's probably more in the other direction. But the people who are actually building the policy plan behind the scenes, they very much have their eyes on how do we make sure that this is banned nationwide.
And that's why Project 2025 is so terrifying.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you something. These hardcore conservatives, they are some creative motherfuckers when it comes to getting done what they want done.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is no, it's not analogous on the Democratic side.
No.
On the Democratic side, you have people like David Dayan wrote that article, here are all the executive orders that Biden could do.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's literally a path for him to do universal health care without any additional new laws on the books, using a provision of Obamacare that gave Libby Montana free health care.
Right.
He could have used that to give the whole country health care during COVID. And the Democrats just don't do it. We already know they could use march-in rights for lowering all prescription drugs, not just that bill that lowered 5 or 10 prices,
yeah,
in the IRA.
Pathetic, yeah.
They could use, there's already a bill, which one? Bayh-Dole? I think it's Bayh-Dole, mm-hmm, Act.
Yep, that's right.
Where they can already step in and control the prices, and they don't do it. Meanwhile, you got these Republicans like, we found a way to do, there's a loophole where we can ban all abortion by misinterpreting this law and then misinterpreting that law and linking them together. It's like, why can't I see this creativity on the Democratic side? It's only on the Republican side. And they're real hardcore, ardent Kool-Aid drinkers. They truly have bought into what their agenda is.
Well, they're willing to actually use power when they have it.
Exactly.
And that's Democrats, right, specialize in finding excuses not to do things.
Because, yeah, they don't really
ways to accomplish things that are good for the people. Because, yeah,
they're not really on the left. Yeah, that's
they don't really want to do those things. Yeah.
All right. So let's go to another interesting and good moment here. We're going to have Biden call out the right, and then a little cameo as well with the funny and smug face of Mayor Pete.
And thanks to our bipartisan infrastructure law, 46,000 new projects have been announced all across your communities. And by the way, I noticed some of you strongly voted against it, or they're cheering on that money coming in. I like it. I'm with you. If any of you don't want that money in your district, just let me know. Modernize our roads.
That is the classic Democratic move right there. The little 1-2 Democratic punch of like, you assholes voted against this, and now you're bragging about it to your constituents.
Yeah.
They did that even, remember back in the day when Obama did that recovery package? It was like $787 billion or something like that, I believe. And all these Republicans were like, I'm very proud to announce this amazing new shovel-ready project in my district.
Yeah.
And the Democrats were like, you voted against the bill. You don't get to come out here and now brag about it. And this is exactly what he's doing. He's calling them out for that. And you saw Mayor Pete kind of enjoyed the burn.
It was a good moment. And also, it was well-delivered. This,
yeah,
felt, mm-hmm, like 2012 Biden.
Yeah. Go ahead, give the money back. It's fine.
Felt punchy, felt charming, felt funny, you know, felt really lucid. So felt sharp. So, yeah, I thought this was a good moment for him. And there are many examples of this, by the way, of Republicans in their district, like touting whatever infrastructure building is coming to their people and leaving out the fact that they actually voted against.
Remember
it.
The Florida lawmaker?
Mm-hmm.
And she went on some local news show thinking it was going to be patty cakes.
Yeah.
And the guy kept hitting her with this, like, you kept celebrating this, but you voted against this bill.
Yeah, and she didn't know what to say.
Yeah, she had no idea. She didn't even know her own damn voting record.
Yeah.
And then he even called
well,
out in another scenario.
She pretended to not know it anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, you also voted against this other bill and you took credit for this.
But
and
see, she's I
like,
don't even think, confronted with it, that it's, if you're a decent politician, I don't think it's that hard to be like, yeah, well, there was a bunch of other stuff in the bill that I didn't support, but I'm very happy that this came through.
You immediately came up with that, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, they're not sending their best.
No, they're not sending their best.
Just take a look at Katie Britt if you want to know more about that.
All right, so we got one more interesting and positive moment for Biden here. This is over Dobbs, and it's kind of like a call out of the Supreme Court, and then the camera cuts to the Supreme Court, and you see how they react to it.
Mm-hmm.
And with all due respect, justices, women are not without electoral power. Electoral or political power. You're about to realize just how much you get right about that. About overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot, we won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024. If you, the American people, send me a Congress that supports the right to choose, I promise you, I'll restore Roe v. Wade as the law of the land again.
Yeah, so that last part's not true.
Right.
That was a lie.
Not
at the end there.
Yeah,
that's not happening.
He just gave that New Yorker interview, too, where he was like, yeah,
I'm not a my body, my choice kind of person.
My body, my choice thing. It's never really been my thing.
Yeah,
so.
Never been on that.
We know his heart is not in it. But like I said, I think people mostly just expect him to not be Trump and not be the Republicans on this issue. I don't think that they actually have the hope that they're going to restore the rights that have already been lost.
Yeah, which is sad. That's
very
sad.
Very sad.
But yeah, the Supreme Court did not look very pleased with that.
There were some real highs and lows in that clip because the line was good.
The coughing was bad.
The delivery of the line and the like, you know, was bad. But this was one of the parts that like triggered some of the beltway types and some of the Republicans of like, how dare you? This is, you know, breach of decorum, blah, blah, blah.
What, but to call out the justices?
To call out the justices directly.
Oh, please.
But I liked that. I liked the line. I wish the delivery was a little more effective, a little smoother on the delivery there. But it was symbolic. That part of the speech in particular was when he was going hard, right? He was going hard at Trump, goes directly at the justices, calling out the Republicans. You know, he was really trying to, it's very clear they had a strategy going into this speech of like, you've got to show that you've still got fight in you. So they front loaded with the most aggressive and most partisan pieces in like a positive way.
Yeah, true. All right. So we got one more. This one, I think we may have a disagreement on it. We'll see. This is another thing on the immigration portion.
Okay.
So let's watch and then we'll react.
In November, my team began serious negotiation with a bipartisan group of senators. The result was a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border security reforms we've ever seen. Oh, you don't think so? Oh, you don't like that bill, huh? That conservatives got together and said it was a good bill? I'll be darned. That's amazing. That bipartisan bill would hire 1,500 more security agents and officers, 100 more immigration judges to help tackle the backload of 2 million cases, 4,300 more asylum officers, and new policies so they can resolve cases in 6 months instead of 6 years now. What are you against?
So here's the thing about that clip. Joe Biden is a walking contradiction and hypocrite on the issue of
Correct.
Immigration.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. Like you said, all the stuff that they said in 2019 when Trump was like the face of being anti-immigration, and they're like, we're actually pro-immigration. And then now they immediately revert back to the Obama era with mass deportations and doing a lot of the Trump policies. And this bill was phenomenally conservative. You know, the way the bill was structured, the Democrats got no concessions on the border. Usually they'd have something in there for the Dreamers or a path to citizenship for people who've been here for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. All that was out the window. They said to Republicans, as long as you vote for Ukraine money and Taiwan money and Israel money, then we'll do whatever you want on the border.
Yep.
That's effectively what happened. All that is true. But from a political perspective, I actually think this is a winner for him because he's doing the whole, you guys say you're tough on the border. I did a tough border bill and you guys all voted against it. So do you actually not believe in the thing that you said you believe in? And then you saw James Lankford there, who was involved in the negotiations.
Yeah.
He's a conservative Republican. And he mouthed, when Biden goes through a bunch of the provisions of the bill, he mouths, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
And I think that to normies, that plays as Biden's right.
My problem with their whole approach to this is that they just accept the Republican framing on immigration.
That's my problem too, yeah.
Yeah, that it should be enforcement only, that the solution is more cruelty, the solution is just, you know, on the enforcement side. And I think we should remember that, first of all, even now, when the polling has shifted some to the Republican side on immigration, but even now, majority of people still believe like immigrants bring more benefit to the country than harm. It still is a majority pro-immigrant country. I mean, there speaks to some real foundational beliefs about who we are and the great melting pot and all of those pieces. And I think it was more effective for Democrats when they had a clear contrast, a clear moral contrast with the Republicans on this issue. I mean, you know, Republicans, obviously, last election when Joe Biden won, they were trying to make immigration an issue. They try to make it every single time. And when Democrats were speaking, at least in more aspirational language, it actually worked for them. Right. I mean, they won when they were speaking like that. I'm not going to claim that was like the core thing. I think there were a lot of other things going on as well. But I don't think that this maneuver that they've engineered is net positive for them. That line, you know, I think that worked relatively well for him in the speech, especially having Lankford sitting there and basically backing him up. But the overall strategy of we're going to accept the Republican framing, we're going to pretend like we're just as cruel assholes, like you're never going to win that fight. They're never going to believe that you're more of a hard ass on the border than Donald Trump would be ultimately.
But don't you think the normie reaction, the normie position on immigration is sort of a mix of a whole bunch of different stuff. It's, hey, we're a nation of immigrants. Immigrants are generally good. They're good for the economy. But then it also is mixed with a healthy dose of like, look, you got to come in legally. You can't come in illegally. You can't jump the line. I've heard so many people say that, even people who are on the Democratic side. And my contention is to normies who are watching that, they don't see the contradiction. They don't see the hypocrisy. They don't see the total 180 that Biden and the Democrats have done on this issue. They just see Biden is in favor of fixing the border crisis. Republicans are not. That's how they see it, I think. I'm not saying the Democratic base,
because
I think the Democratic base, as in young people and certain minority groups, I think they'll look at this for what it is.
Yeah.
But I think net in the aggregate, the more normie reaction to this is going to be like, I think he's right that they came up with something trying to fix the problem and it was blocked by the Republicans. And here you even have a conservative Republican who's saying Biden's right. And the right has gone so insane and so extreme and so fringe, nothing's ever enough. And so they don't want to fix the problem when at least Biden and the Democrats and the bipartisan group of Republicans are at least trying to fix the problem. I'm not saying that's the correct view of it. I'm just saying I think that's how people see it.
I think that makes some assumptions that I don't agree with. Number one is that people are paying close enough attention to know all the ins and outs of, oh, they had this bill in a bipartisan working group and they tried this and they gave the Republicans everything they wanted and the Republicans still blocked it. Like, I think probably more likely the normie reaction is just like, oh, I'm still seeing these images of chaos at the border and it's under Biden's presidency, so it's Biden's fault. You know, I think that's the more likely analysis to come from people who are, you know, not fully engaged in this and not listening and paying attention to all the ins and outs of Washington. That's number one. Number two, I think most of the people who are voting on immigration are Republicans anyway. And so there's a very remarkable and noteworthy contrast between the two issues where Biden has the lowest approval ratings at this point are immigration and Gaza. And on immigration, obviously, the discontent is largely from the right. And in response to that, he's completely caved to their views and their wishes and their demands, even though most of the people for whom immigration is the number one issue, again, are never going to vote for Joe Biden. Like, if immigration is your number one thing, you are voting for Donald Trump. And yet they bend over backwards to accede to their wishes. And yet on Gaza, the other issue where he has the worst approval rating, where the pressure is coming from the left, it's nothing but like, screw you, basically. And I'm not changing my policy an inch. I'll throw you a little bit of like PR bullshit with this port nonsense. But that's it.
Yeah, we just have a disagreement on it because I think I just think the perception of it to people who are not paying that much attention is, look, they tried to fix it and the Republicans blocked it, you know? And I agree that I don't think people are too wrapped up in the details of it, but it's that thought that leads me to my conclusion.
See, I think the more that you focus on immigration and make that and accept the Republican framing of this is chaos, this is a crisis, we've got to crack down, the weaker ground you're going to be on. You're never going to win that fight against Donald Trump. You're just never going to convince people like I'll be more of a border hard ass than Donald Trump.
I mean, you're right. But at the same time, that is literally what happened is they were being border badasses. And the right was like, we're against that.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's just
but reality and the politics don't always match up.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's all I got for you. That's all we got.
The last thing we should note is that there were some polls that came out right afterwards of how people perceived the speech. Now, keep in mind, usually when
I forgot to bring that up.
When it's a Democratic president, it's more Democrats who watch the speech than Republicans. So it is a bit of a skewed sample. But it was, you know, it was favorable. I think I saw like 62%, the CNN poll, right? 62% said that he did a good job. So, and his policies were good for the country. So, you know, I think net graded on a curve, lowest bar imaginable. This was a solid night for him. This did what he needed to do in terms of, you know, quieting down some of the rising media concerns about his age. I don't think it really does anything to curb the overall public concerns about his age, which are still very much there in President
Trump. That's interesting. I think it actually does change that a little bit.
You think so?
Not a lot, but I think a little bit. So to your point,
I don't really think so.
It is 62% of people polled who watched the speech say Biden's policies will move the country in the right direction. Before the speech, it was 45%.
Yeah.
So it went from 45 to 62.
Yeah.
Which that's, that is a pretty big jump.
So you think the next time they poll on, like, is he too old, you think it'll be improved?
It goes down a little bit, yeah. But look, he's already at 86%. So if it goes down to 76%.
It's still bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I could see, I guess I'll grant you this. I could see in the short term that happening, but we know we're going to have another, like, Biden brain dead moment in like, you know, two days time. So
I don't think
that's going to be a lasting benefit from this speech.
No, that's undeniable. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right, guys. So there you go. There you have it. That's our breakdown. As I already pointed out about 47 times, everybody sign up on Substack. That link is below. We love y'all. Thank you for funding the show and letting us do it. We appreciate you and we'll see you next week. Peace.